Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nadia Hijab, senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, who discusses the continuing violence in Gaza, the search for a negotiated solution to the conflict, and an end to the Palestinian Authority's international isolation. Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, who comments on the post-election resignation of Donald Rumsfeld and the nomination of Robert Gates as the new Secretary of Defense. And Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses the message he believes voters sent to Washington on November 7th and outlines top priorities for the incoming Democratic congressional majority. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early October, President George Bush signed into law a new national space policy that rejects prospective arms control agreements which might limit American military options in space. The policy document, the first space policy overhaul in a decade, focuses on security issues, promotion of free enterprise in space, and limits restraint on US leadership. Critics like Teresa Hitchens of the Center for Defense Information sharply criticized the new policy. She told the Washington Post, "The new policy kicks the door a little more open for a space war fighting strategy and has a very unilateral tone to it." In 2004, the US Air Force issued its Counter-Space Operations Doctrine that calls for a more aggressive military posture in space while protecting US satellites and spacecraft. In the near future, the Pentagon is expected to develop new dual-use weapons designed for civilian use with the capacity to blind or shoot down enemy satellites. The US had long rejected international efforts to ban weapons in space. In October 2005, the Bush administration voted against a measure at the UN General Assembly calling for negotiations on space weapons. Washington was alone among 160 nations opposing a space weapons treaty. In a sign of its growing clout, China attracted leaders of 48 African nations to a two-day summit in Beijing. The payday for the Africans was significant, $5 billion in new aid and nearly $2 billion in new trade deals. China is courting African nations for natural resources to fuel its economic engine. European powers took over the continent in the late 1800s, and multinational oil companies staked their claims in the 1960s and 70s. According to The Economist magazine, trade between Africa and China has exploded tenfold over the last decade. China is now a major importer of African oil, making deals with Sudan and Angola. Chinese companies also plan to build a new 800-mile railroad in Nigeria between Lagos and Kano. China's growing economic strength has raised human rights concerns. Beijing has opposed deploying United Nations peacekeepers in conflict-ridden Darfur and bailed out Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe, who has suppressed his opponents. As Human Rights Watch observed, Africa does not need another external power enabling abusing regimes. They need all the powers, including China, to place human rights at the center of their policies. In a move to go upscale, Walmart, America's largest retailer, is expanding its offering of organic foods. By taking organic into the mainstream, Walmart is putting new pressure on organic producers, mostly small farmers struggling to survive. Farmers may feel pressure to reduce organic standards in order to sell to Walmart, or stay independent to maintain quality and consequently lose market share. Bob Scowcroft of the Organic Farmers Research Foundation hails the Walmart move. He told The Nation magazine, "It will bring hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland into the organic fold." In contrast, Mark Castell of the Cornucopia Institute says Walmart will demand lower prices from small farmers and degrade the whole notion of what is organic. This disturbing trend is seen in the production of organic milk. Organic Valley, a cooperative of small dairy farmers, sold to Walmart, but soon faced a milk shortage. To fill the gap, Walmart also sold organic milk produced by Horizon, owned by Dean Foods, but Organic Valley declined to engage in a price war with Horizon, which has been accused of mistreating their cows under factory farming conditions. Organic Valley eventually stopped selling to Walmart, and the Organic Consumers Association urged shoppers to boycott Horizon. The association is now working to improve organic production standards while making these foods more affordable for all consumers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
After unilaterally withdrawing from Gaza in September 2005, the Israeli army reinvaded in June to search for a kidnapped Israeli soldier. Since then, about 400 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed, half of them civilians and at least 75 of them children. Despite the withdrawal, Palestinians say they have been under continuous Israeli siege. On November 8th, the Israelis mistakenly shelled a home and killed 19 Gazan civilians, including 7 children, in the town of Beit Hanun, triggering worldwide outrage. The U.S. recently vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution condemning the attack, saying the measure was biased against Israel. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority government, led by the militant Islamic Hamas Party, elected in January in a ballot deemed free and fair, has been totally isolated. Hamas has been spurned as a result of Israeli and Western nations' demand that the party must recognize Israel's right to exist, renounce violence, and honor previous agreements. Most international aid and financial transactions have been frozen, even from Arab states. But the suffering of the Palestinian people, along with continued attacks by Israel, has brought about dialogue between Hamas and Fatah, the party which formerly led the Palestinian government. On November 13th, a retired university president in the Gaza Strip emerged as the top candidate to head a new national unity government being formed to end the Palestinian Authority's isolation. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nadia Hijab, senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies in Washington, D.C. She discusses the continuing violence in Gaza and the search for a negotiated solution to the conflict and an end to the Palestinian Authority's international isolation.
After the attack on Beit Hanun, the Arab foreign ministers met, and after the United States vetoed the UN Security Council resolution condemning the attack, Arab foreign ministers met in Cairo and said, okay, we are no longer going to boycott the Palestinian government. You know, we are personally going to get money to them, and we're not going to abide by the U.S. and Israeli-led boycott of the Hamas government.
So that's a big change. Do you think that will be carried through and will actually reduce the suffering of the people of Gaza significantly?
It will reduce the suffering. It also sends out a signal of hope that, and it shows that the front that was established against this government has cracked. And it's also a big sort of blow to U.S. policy in the region. I mean, the U.S. has been calling the shots, and now for the first time in a long time, Arab governments are saying, well, this is it. You know, you shouldn't have vetoed the resolution on Beit Hanun, and we're not going to go along with this anymore. It'll take some time for the money to get through. As a quid pro quo, the Palestinian foreign minister, who was a member of Hamas, was at that meeting in Cairo, and the Arab foreign ministers all together collectively approved an Arab peace initiative. So that's being presented as Hamas coming on board with the platform of achieving peace with Israel.
Nadia Hijab, Israel continues to shell Gaza. It says in response to these quite ineffective rockets that Palestinians are sending across the border into Israel. Olmert apologized for the latest disaster, but he didn't rule out similar attacks in the future to protect Israeli citizens.
Well, you know, the attacks on Gaza are not going to stop the rockets. I mean, it's as simple as that, because just as they were leaving Gaza, more rockets were fired into Israel. You're talking about a people that's extremely frustrated, has no sovereignty, has no freedom. It has no basic human rights. And so if the only thing they can do is fire rockets at Israeli towns, that's what they're going to do. And shelling the civilians to try and put pressure on militants to stop firing rockets, it's not going to work. And various analysts have said this, including the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, writing in Haaretz. He says that the Palestinians fire the rockets because it's the only thing that draws the attention of the world to their plight and the situation they're living under. Now, 41 Israelis have been wounded since September 2005 by those rockets, but that's certainly not equivalent to about 525 Palestinians have been killed during that same period. I mean, obviously the rockets are not a good thing, but the way to stop the rockets is to negotiate peace. It's not to say we're going to carry on killing and hitting.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas called for an end to the firing of rockets by Palestinians into Israeli territory, saying it's counterproductive.
Yeah, he's called for an end to the rockets. Hamas has actually maintained the rockets are not being fired, or were not being fired by Hamas, which maintained until the attack on Beit Hanun, a ceasefire, a unilateral ceasefire with Israel. So I think if Israel would one day declare a ceasefire or negotiate a ceasefire, so that it was a reciprocal ceasefire, then you would begin to go on the road to peace. But so far, only the Palestinians have upheld the ceasefire. And then nothing happens, nothing happens to change the situation.
Do you see signs of hope?
At the moment, I mean, I think one sign of hope is the maturity with which the Palestinians are behaving in spite of the enormous pressure on them. The other sign of hope is this decision by the Arab foreign ministers. And finally, the third sign of hope is the victory of the Democrats in the recent elections in the U.S., because that means that the forces within the U.S., the neocons that were really pushing this agenda of you can go and reshape countries and regions through use of brute military force, that agenda is on its way out. So hopefully there'll be more of a turn to multilateralism, to negotiations, to, a push towards peace that is more even-handed. I don't think there's going to be an immediate change here in the States, but at least, with the departure of the Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, that whole neoconservative agenda appears to be on the way out.
That was Nadia Hijab of the Institute for Palestine Studies in Washington, D.C. Call the Institute at area code 202-342-3990 or visit the group's website at www.palestine-studies.org. With the November 7th congressional election serving as a referendum on President Bush's failed policies on the Iraq War, the resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld the day after a sweeping Democratic Party victory was not surprising. As Rumsfeld left the scene, President Bush nominated former CIA Director Robert Gates as his successor. Gates, who was forced to withdraw his nomination for CIA Director in 1987 due to his ties to the Reagan-era Iran-Contra scandal, came back to narrowly win the post in 1991, serving under President Bush's father. During his career at the National Security Council and CIA, Gates has been accused of politicizing intelligence on the Soviet Union and in other areas critical to formulating U.S. foreign policy. Gates' checkered history is of concern to many observers, and that the Iraq War was justified by flawed and manipulated intelligence with regard to non-existent weapons of mass destruction and the dubious threat posed by Saddam Hussein. With the violence in Iraq continuing to surge in what many are now openly labeling a civil war, President Bush is awaiting advice from his father's Secretary of State, James Baker, who heads the bipartisan Iraq Study Group, which will soon make recommendations on changing U.S. policy on the war. Robert Gates was a member of the study group until his nomination. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst who is now a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Goodman comments on the nomination of Robert Gates for Secretary of Defense and why he advocates a rapid withdrawal from Iraq.
Politicizing intelligence is violating the Holy Grail at the CIA. I can't think of a greater sin at the CIA than to lie about intelligence. But, of course, that's exactly what Bob Gates did throughout the 1980s. He did it for himself. He did it for Bill Casey. Lied about intelligence on the Soviet Union, on Central America, on the Middle East, on Afghanistan, on the Persian Gulf, arms control and disarmament. It was almost a case of, you name the area, and I can tell you how he distorted the intelligence in order to adhere to the policy prescriptions of his boss at that time, CIA Director Bill Casey, when he was deputy to Bill Casey. And then finally, I guess my last word on this subject is this is not a man who's ever been known for telling truth to power. This is in the best Soviet language. He's an apparatchik. This is a man who serves his master, but really has tunnel vision and is just temperamentally unsuited to delegate authority or responsibility. He's a terrible micromanager. I work with Bob Gates. I work for Bob Gates. I can testify to that. And when you look at the really mediocre secretaries of defense that we've had in the last 40 years, and the worst would be Bob McNamara and now Donald Rumsfeld, they were terrible micromanagers as well. So this is not a good fit. Again, he's the morning after pill. He'll be welcomed for aborting Donald Rumsfeld when he arrives for work after he gets confirmed in December. But this could be a very fraught kind of relationship, Bob Gates and the uniformed military of the United States.
What do you expect that this Iraq survey group is going to come up with by way of policy prescriptions for George Bush, given that he's looking for some way out or looking for some way to justify sending more troops in or whatever his ultimate goal is here, whether it's victory or success, because the words have changed recently. But what do you expect that this Iraq survey group, this committee, will come up with to advise the president?
Well, I don't expect anything profound. In fact, I expect pablum. And here's why. I don't think this is a policy group. I don't think this is a very substantive group. There are 10 individuals on it. Not one is a specialist or an expert on the Middle East. Not one understands Iraq. Not one understands the geopolitical machinations of the Middle East, which are all fragile right now because of our invasion of Iraq. I think it's a political group. Not a policy group. Political in the sense that Bush never wanted this group to be formed in the first place. It was the Congress that sort of imposed it on him. Here it's somewhat comparable to the 9/11 Commission, which Bush didn't want and tried to undercut by naming Henry Kissinger as the first chairman of the 9/11 Commission. Right. Here he did something a little smarter, however. You know, if you have a commission and it's forced on you, you don't want it, well, then you co-opt it. And what I consider is the naming of Jim Baker, the Republican, and Lee Hamilton, the Democrat, as co-chairman. That's excellent co-opting of the commission. So Iraq is heading toward chaos. It's in a civil war. We don't like to use that term. The fact of the matter is the civil war started in February of this year when the Sunnis attacked the mosque in Samarra. And every month since then, a battalion of American troops has been killed. So we're losing blood. We're losing treasure. We're losing credibility. The Bush administration is losing its standing and any meaning it would have as a strong force in international security. And I don't see Bob Gates turning this around. I don't see the Iraq Aid Survey Group turning this around.
Well, Mel Goodman, what's your policy prescription for the United States in Iraq? And what do you think the Democrats, who are now taking the majority in the House and Senate, what can they do, what should they do to extricate the United States from this horrendous war, this very bloody war in Iraq?
Well, I think the people have spoken, and I think the people have spoken correctly. That's how I look at this very important, very significant election. And I think that people no longer believe what they're being told about Iraq. The people know that we've been lied to get into this war, and of course that's what happened. We use fabricated intelligence and specious intelligence to get into the war. They want the troops to come home. What we have to fess up to is two things. One, we have to get out. You can't get out quickly. The idea of establishing early deadlines is impossible. You would endanger American lives in that process, but we have to start to debate retrenchment. And fortunately, Carl Levin, who will take over the Armed Forces Committee in January, has started us down this road. And he's a very intelligent and thoughtful man. I have a lot of respect for him, particularly when he engages an issue, and we're lucky it's in his hands. Two, we have to discuss reparations. We are responsible for the tremendous amount of destruction that's taken place in Iraq, and we're going to have to pay for that, along with the British. The worst decision ever made by a president, and the most profligate decision ever made by an American president. But we're stuck with that. But we can't keep putting it off. We can't keep kicking this can down the road, which is what Bush would like to do, and turn it over to his successor, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. It's got to stop. We have to start the process in terms of beginning the end of this war now, not wait for 2 years. That, I think, is unacceptable to the American people.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. The November 7th midterm congressional election landslide for Democrats was comparable to only two other ballots in recent U.S. history. The 1974 sweep of Democrats in the wake of the Nixon-era Watergate scandal and the Republican tidal wave of 1994 during Bill Clinton's presidency. Democrats picked up at least 29 seats in the House and beat six GOP incumbents in the U.S. Senate to take control of both legislative bodies. Additionally, Democrats gained six new governorships and took control of nine new state legislatures. According to exit polls, the two most important issues for voters in this election were opposition to the war in Iraq and disgust with corruption and scandal in the Republican-controlled Congress. Statewide referendum results also yielded good news for progressives in that six states voted to raise the minimum wage. Missouri voters passed a stem cell research initiative, and South Dakota rejected a virtual total ban on abortion. Opinion polls indicate that the public overwhelmingly supports the agenda of the incoming Democratic majority on a wide range of issues, including raising the minimum wage, extending health insurance to the uninsured, negotiating lower prices for prescription drugs in the Medicare program, and implementation of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who discusses what message he believes voters sent to Washington on November 7th and the issues which should be priorities for the Democrats on domestic and foreign policy as they take office in January.
Well, I think the country took a step back from the abyss. I mean, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, the unlamented, were driving this country over a cliff at breakneck speed, and the country on November 7th said, slow down, even though Cheney said, full speed ahead. So I think it is a relief to a majority of the American people who voted on November 7th. It's a huge relief to me. And it's an ounce or two of comeuppance for Bush and for Cheney, who have been so heedless of the wishes of the American people, heedless of U.S. law, heedless of international law. They were ruling as though it were almost a dictatorship that was affirmed every 4 years, never mind the two-year elections. That's why Cheney's comment right before November 7th, that it didn't matter what the voters said, it was full steam ahead, was so galling to so many people. So I think, you know, knocking Bush down a couple notches is healthy for the country. And then the question is this just a corrective, a move to the center? I don't see it that way. I see it, first of all, the main issue was the Iraq War, and the American people want out of the Iraq War. That was loud and clear on November 7th. And also the populist message that America needs a raise, that the minimum wage needs to go up. That was loud and clear, too. I mean, every time the minimum wage is on the ballot, I think it was on the ballot in six or eight states, it passed. And a lot of populists won. And you have the first socialist in the Senate, the avowed socialist, Bernie Sanders, and you have Sherrod Brown, a populist in Ohio, which is traditionally kind of a Republican state, and you have John Tester, a populist in a very Republican state of Montana. So I don't see this as an affirmation of some, ballyhooed center of the American body politic. I think it's a move to the left. It's a move to the progressive side on foreign policy. It's a move to the progressive populist side on economic issues. I think it's about time.
What about Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, respectively, the leaders of the House and Senate with a new Democratic majority? There's, this media spin that, the country's in the center, moving to the center, and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, if they're smart, they'll take control of the House and the Senate from the center. What do you think?
I think it's the wrong conclusion to draw. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, even before a vote was cast, was saying we got to take impeachment off the table. Harry Reid was saying, you know, the second the votes were tallied, we got to move to the center. But a lot of what the American people were saying wasn't move to the center, was move to the left, move to the left on Iraq War, move to the left on economic issues. And a lot of people are for impeachment. And not to investigate the Bush administration for Katrina or for Iraq or for the NSA spying scandal or for Halliburton is really just to shirk the Democrats' responsibility. I'm not talking about exacting a pound of flesh for partisan gain. I'm talking about doing what they're supposed to do, what the Constitution says they're supposed to do, which is to hold the other branch accountable. And if the other branch has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, as Bush and Cheney have, the only constitutional remedy for that is impeachment. Now, the crazy thing is that for the last 5 years or so, the Democrats have had a bad case of subpoena envy. And now they've got the power. Why don't they use that subpoena power and drag these criminal officials before them?
Matthew, as I'm sure you share the sentiment, one of the most alarming things we've witnessed in the past bunch of years under the Bush administration is the shredding of the U.S. Constitution. What do you think the Democrats can do to revive the Constitution, to repair the Constitution after all these abuses of power have taken place on torture, on wiretapping, on imprisonment without charge or trial?
Well, I think impeachment would be one first step there. I think repealing the Military Commissions Act would be another. This is one of the most anti-American acts that has ever been passed, and it was passed in the last Congress. This is now the law that lets the President of the United States grab your relatives who are coming overseas to visit you and throw them in jail for life without ever allowing them to see a judge. The President alone can do that without anybody else interfering. That isn't due process of law. That you know, rips up not only the Bill of Rights, but the Magna Carta. And so that is where we are today. We are a much less free country today, and unless the Democrats stand up and say, look, George Bush rescinded the Bill of Rights, and we can't let him get away with that, then they're not fully standing up to the plate.
Well, what would your advice be to grassroots groups, be they peace organizations or economic justice groups that are out there and, you know, horrified as to what's happened over the last 6 years under the Bush administration? Now they have some Democrats who may be willing to sit down and talk with them or at least pay attention when there's a march out in the street. What do you think's the best tactic here?
Well, they've got to pressure their elected officials in every which way we know how to pressure people. That is by phone calls and emails and letters, but also by, you know, picketing outside their office if they're voting the wrong way, if they're saying, you know, we're not going to pursue impeachment when they want impeachment, or they're not going to be for withdrawal of U.S. troops when a majority of American people want withdrawal of troops. We've got to use all those nonviolent efforts that we've, you know, put into practice over the years and put our pressure on these people to make them do what's right, not what's expedient.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine. Read Rothschild's commentaries online at www.progressive.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Prue Cullen, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.